What about you? Do you have family? My throat squeezed.
Since I lost my mother, I had seen family as only a liability. Even growing close to Ren and Sinove seemed like a terrible risk. The world was so much safer when you only had yourself to lose. Yes, I answered. I have family. Both of my parents live in Venda.
What are they like?
I searched for an answer, something that would make his questions stop. Happy, content, and very proud of their only daughter, I said, then steered the conversation elsewhere. Though I was no stranger to hunger, our foraging had been scant, so I was overjoyed when we came to a creek and I spotted wishstocks growing at its banks. I was surprised that he had no knowledge of them. In Venda, they were a spring treat, growing in wide thickets in bogs. My mother and I would go gather them just outside the city walls. Make a wish, Cassie. With each one you pick, make a wish for tomorrow, the next day, and the next. One will always come true. The magic of the wishes, of course, was simply in making them, fishing deep for a hidden desire, molding it into words to make it real, and tossing it into a mysterious unknown that you believed was maybe, just maybe, listening. Even at 6 years old, I knew wishes didn't come true, but I made them just the same. It felt rich and wild and as indulgent and marvelous as a rare dinner of pigeon and parsnips. For a few minutes, a wish put a sword in my hand and gave me power over the grimness of our world. I picked several, making silent wishes with each one. Jace looked at my handful of stalks like they were weeds.
What do they do besides grant wishes?
It was obvious that he had never skipped a meal in his life, much less a week of meals. You'll see, I answered. We sat down on the bank, cooling our ankles in the creek, and I told him to chew. Don't eat the stalk, just swallow the juice. I explained that the juice was not unlike nectar and just as nourishing. But the real magic is this, I said, and took the pulpy stalk I had chewed and split it open so it lay flat. Give me your ankle, I said, pointing to the chained one. He pulled it from the creek, and I slipped the flattened stalk beneath the shackle where his skin was cut. You'll start to feel the difference soon, I said. It has... I glanced up at him and found his eyes were focused on me, not his ankle. I froze, thinking there was something he was about to say. Our gazes remained locked, and there were questions in his eyes, but not the kind I could answer. My breath stopped up in my chest.
It's awkward, isn't it?
He said. What's that? I replied, my voice far too breathy.
These moments when we're not hating each other.
I swallowed and looked away. But it seemed there was nothing to look at, and the moment only grew more uncomfortable, and my jaw ached from clenching it. He was right. It was awkward. This was not something I was good at. I was good at running away, distance, disappearing. Not this. Not at being confronted with him over and over again, never having more than 3 feet of space between us. And I hated that I actually found him likable. I shouldn't have liked him at all. And I hated the other things I noticed about him, too, little things that caught my attention. Like the way his hair fell over his eyes when he stooped to build a fire. The interesting quirk of his right brow when he was angry. The 4 small freckles on his arm that would make a J if a line connected them. The way the light caught the stubble on his chin. I was a connoisseur of detail, but I didn't like the details I saw. I hated that I found him appealing. Not just his appearance, but the confidence of his strides, the calculations in his gaze, his cockiness, his damned voice. I hated the ridiculous flip-flop my stomach did just now when I caught him looking at me. I was not Sinove. Maybe most of all, I hated that I found any kindness in him at all. I hated that I'd had to swallow a knot in my throat that first night when I realized he was trying to help me sleep, as he had every night since then. Those I had tricked and stolen from in the past had never been kind. It made it easy to turn them into fools and steal from them.
You were saying? It has...
he asked. I knew he was trying to give me some coherent thought to occupy myself. Healing qualities. It has healing qualities.
Here, let me put this one on your ankle.
I can do it myself, I said, and took the chewed stalk from him, fussing over it again and again as I pressed it onto my ankle.
I think you have it in the right position,
he said, and I finally left it alone. We sat there for silent minutes, chewing more stalks and breaking several more in half to stuff in our pockets. He leaned over, looking at his ankle.
The sting is gone. Thank you.
His voice. There was no mistaking the kindness I heard. I nodded and finally felt composed enough to look at him. Thank you, too.
For?
Keeping me still when the Kandok came upon us? I answered. I might have ended up as his breakfast. His mouth pulled in a frown.
Nah, one bite and he'd have spit you out. You're not even close to being sweet enough.
I suppressed a smile. I was much more at ease with his disparaging remarks. He stood and put his hand out to help me up.
We should get going, Kazi of Bright Mist.
I took it and stood. You seem to like calling me that. Why?
Because I'm not sure that's your real name. You appear to have a lot of hidden sides to you. Juggling, telling riddles, taking down boys and threatening to cut their pretty necks.
I grimaced and shook my head, sizing up his neck. It's not so pretty. He rubbed his neck as if offended.
Anything else up your sleeve I should know about?
If I told you, it wouldn't be fun, would it?
Should I be concerned?
Probably.
They tricked us. Their voices were soft. Their heads bowed. They did not look dangerous. They looked like us. Afraid. Until we opened the gate. They stabbed Razim and laughed. They left him for dead. And we couldn't open the door to get him until they were gone. I heard the name of one of them as they ran away. One day I will be stronger than I am now. One day I will call his name, and I will kill him. Theo, 11. Chapter 13, Kazi.
I'm not sure that's your real name. Oddly, that was probably the least complicated and most true thing about me. Kazi Myra of Bright Mist. My mother had come from the northern province of Balwood, venturing to Sanctum City like so many others who crowded in there hoping it offered a better life than the harsh terrain beyond it. But she came there with the added burden of a baby in her belly and only a handful of coins. She never talked of my father. I didn't know if he was alive or dead, if she had loved or hated him, or if she had even known him at all. Traveling alone across the barren plains was a dangerous prospect for anyone. "He's gone, Kazi," was all she had said. And she seemed sad, so I didn't ask again. The quarter of Bright Mist was in the northern part of the city. She managed to find an unoccupied hovel there that would keep the rain off, and a midwife, so that was where she settled. Jace wasn't the first one to question my name, wondering if it was real. Most of those we encountered in the city had never heard the name Cassie. When asked about it, my mother told them it was a Highland name that meant spring. Another time, she had said, it meant little bird. And another time, God's messenger. I realized she didn't know what it meant at all, and once she was gone, the name didn't seem to matter. Who or what I was became a forgotten detail. Any name would do, and all kinds were pulled from the air to run me off. Scat, you nasty vermin, brat, pest, crapcake. Until I devised a way to make them want me to stay. The thing about a mark is they've created lies in their head, a story they've invented that they desperately want to believe, a fantasy that merely needs to be fed patiently. You are kinder, more beautiful, shrewder, wiser. You are deserving. Eat up. Like a round-mouthed fish breaking the surface of the water, following after a trail of breadcrumbs. Draw them closer with one morsel, two, and then hook them behind the gills, senseless and flapping, oblivious to what they have really lost because their bloated stomach is full. Cassie Myra, I would sometimes whisper to myself as I slunk away with a meal hidden beneath my coat, because there were days even I forgot who I had once been. I made more of an effort to erase Jace's suspicions and convince him I was only a soldier, telling him about my training and life in the sanctum. But even with that, I had to carefully edit the truth. Training as Ratan was different. The drills, hours, and study were endless. Probably the only thing I failed at was swimming, but only for lack of practice. I was smaller than most of the pledges and had to work twice as hard to prove myself. That part was easy to do. The hardest thing I had to learn was to sleep in a bed, not under it. Most nights, to save myself the anguish, I simply snuck off with a blanket to a hidden dark passage under the stairs. One night, the queen had unexpectedly joined me. I remembered I had stared furiously at the lantern flame, focusing on it rather than her. I had felt shame for huddling in the dark. She sat on the floor next to me, the tunnel too small for us to stand. "I came here too," she had said. It was a dark, safe space for me. There were many days I feared would be my last here in the sanctum. I was so afraid then. Some days, I'm still afraid. I have so many promises to keep. But you have kept your promises. Freedoms are never won once and for all, Cassie Myra. They come and go, like the centuries. I cannot grow lazy. Memories are short. It is the forgetting that I fear. That was what I feared, too. Forgetting. But none of this could I share with Jace. When he asked me if juggling was part of Ratan training, I laughed it off and said it was just something I had picked up along the way. "What way is that?" "Digging." I told him a friend taught me.
"You have clever friends."
"Yes, I do," I answered, offering no more information. I was self-taught. Desperation can be a good teacher, maybe the best teacher. I had to perfect new skills quickly or starve. But his comment about friends made me think of Ren and Sinove. They came to the sanctum a few months after I did, both caught in scuffles with no immediate family to summon. Being the same ages and having known one another on the streets, we were naturally drawn together. After 2 years, Caden, the Queen's Keep, had the final say on who would advance to Rattan training. He had given us a long, stern look, trying to decide if all three of us would move on to the next level. Surprisingly, his wife, Pauline, had shot him a stern look in our favor. We'd trained and worked together ever since. I hoped they were safely tucked away, sitting tight. Sinove entertaining Ren with the mundane details of the Rakah. Yes, our plan had gone awry, but they were inventive and we had backup plans. By now, they had probably figured out I wasn't inside Tor's watch. How much farther is the settlement?
I'm not sure. I forgot to bring my map and compass. Why don't you dig out yours?
You think we're still on course?
Yes,
he answered emphatically. I wasn't sure if he was annoyed that it was the second time I had asked, or simply unhappy that we'd be walking into the Caswell settlement and Venden territory, whether he liked it or not. He continued to tell me more stories about Tor's watch that I had to admit fascinated me. I looked forward to them. This morning he'd told me about Breida's Tears, a series of 7 cascading waterfalls in the Moro Mountains. They were named for the goddess Breida, who had come to Earth and fallen in love with the mere mortal Eris. Their love was so great that new flowers sprang up in their footsteps, flowers more beautiful than any that the gods had ever created, and the gods became jealous. They forbade Breida from returning to Earth, and when she disobeyed, they struck Eris dead. Her grief was so overwhelming that rivers of tears fell from the heavens, rushing down the mountains where they once walked, creating waterfalls that still flow to this day.
And there are flowers that grow at the base of those waterfalls that grow nowhere else on the mountain.
So it must be true, I said. He smiled.
Must be. I'll show you one day.
A clumsy silence fell. We both knew he would never show me, but his words had slipped out easily before he could stop them, as if he were talking to a friend. There were more awkward moments. Yesterday morning, I awoke to his arms slung over me, his chest nesting close to my back. He was unaware, probably seeking some warmth in his sleep. I lay there, not moving away, thinking about the weight of his arm, how it felt, the soft sound of his breaths, the heat of his skin. It was a reckless, indulgent minute, wondering what he dreamed of, and then sense flooded back in, and I carefully nudged his arm away before he woke up. I made a conscious effort not to touch him. I think he had done the same, but sleep had become its own thief, stealing away our intentions. As we walked, I plied him with questions, sprinkled carefully so they would seem offhand and casual, mostly about Tor's watch. I learned it was a sprawling complex of homes and buildings that housed the offices of the Ballinger business empire. Their income came from multiple sources, but he didn't tell me what they all were. When I thought he sensed I was digging, I changed the topic to something else, but I did learn that a hefty portion of their revenue came from the trading arena, a large exchange where buyers and sellers from all over the continent came to trade goods. It began with the grain grown in Islandia, but with more trade opening up between the kingdoms since the new treaties, the arena had tripled in size every year since. Am I hearing this right? I asked, laying on my thickest mocking tone. You're saying you have benefited from the new treaties?
In some ways, but not so much that we're willing to give up who we are.
He rubbed his bare finger just below the knuckle where his signet ring had once been. It was another tick I had noticed. He did it frequently when he talked of home. I imagined the struggle that had ensued when the hunter tried to take it from him. I was certain Jace hadn't given it up easily. I supposed he was lucky he still had his finger at all. I pushed my hand into the bottom of my pocket and fingered the warm circle of metal and wondered if I should give it to him, but it seemed too late now. He would wonder why I had taken it in the first place, and especially why it took me so long to hand it over. The keys I had taken for survival. The ring was for an entirely different reason. In the year before the queen came, more of my stealing had become punitive. It was an angry tax I collected for answers I never received, and a retribution for all the fingertips of children taken by quarter lords and then fed to the swine. Most of the punitive thefts were for items that held no value. They could not fill a belly, but they filled me in other ways. The smallest, most useless thing I ever stole was a shiny brass button that made the Tomac quarter lord so very proud. It protruded from his belly among a long line of shiny buttons on his jacket, a rare treasure he had bought from a Pervisi driver. To me, they looked like fat, golden rivets holding his belly in place. Stealing the middle button had ruined the entire showy effect. I had stalked him for a week, knowing just when he would pass down one small, crowded alley, throngs shoving against him, and I was there, my cap pulled low, my small, curved blade in the palm of my hand. He didn't know it was gone until he reached the end of the alley and I heard his bellowing screech. I had smiled at the sweet sound. It was all the supper I needed. Jace's ring was just as useless to me as that button had been, and I had stolen it for the same reason. It was a symbol of power, a legacy they revered, and in one quiet move I had relegated it to the bottom of my dark, dirty pocket.
Chapter 14. Jace.
She had an intense curiosity, and I was happy to feed it with stories about Tor's watch. But when it came to her own life, her words became reserved and calculated. Being chained to someone hour after hour, day after day, gives every pause a hidden weight. I dwelled on the details she wouldn't share. What had her life been like in Venda? Or maybe, more precisely, what had they done to her? She was not the result of happy, content parents. It was like she'd been held prisoner in a cellar her whole life. She flinched at sun and an open sky. As soon as we hit the Heath Plateau, she kept her eyes straight ahead on some distant point, her focus like steel, her shoulders rigid, like she carried a heavy pack on her back. When I pointed out an eagle soaring above us, she barely gave it a glance. I turned the conversation back to something that she seemed confident about, being a soldier. She told me about the various weapons that were forged for the rattan. The knives, zeeths, swords, rope darts, crossbows, and more. The fortress keep assessed what best suited their strengths. Her sword and knives were presented to her by the queen when she became Rattan. Have you ever used them? She raised a brow. You mean, have I ever killed anyone? Yes, only two so far. I try to avoid it if I can. If I can. She said it so casually, unruffled, the same girl who I had to coax riddles from each night so she could sleep under an open sky. Who did you kill? I asked. Raiders, she answered. A frown pulled at the corner of her mouth, as if she was still disgusted by the encounter. We were rear guard on a supply train. They didn't see us hanging back. That was the point. But we saw them. What about you? Have you ever killed anyone? I nodded. Far more than three, but I didn't tell her how many, and I was glad she didn't ask. More than once, she caught me studying her. I tried to focus on the landscape, but my eyes drifted back to her again and again. She fascinated me, her contradictions, her secrets, and the girl that sometimes surfaced from beneath her tough soldier exterior. like when she spotted the wish stalks on the bank. The girl who forgot who I was and pressed a wish stalk to my ankle. In another world, another circumstance, I think we might have been friends. Or more. I knew that I spent more time wondering about her than I should. I scanned the foothills ahead, trying to concentrate, trying to push my mind back to where it should be. I had ridden this way before, but had never walked at all on foot, especially not barefoot, chained, and half-starved. It was hard to judge distances. How much farther was it? Was there any chance of getting back before they sealed the tomb? What was going through all of their minds? Where the hell is Jace? No doubt search parties had been sent out, but no body had been found. I was certain that the Ratan with Cassie were in my brother's custody by now, being interrogated. Mason could squeeze information out of anyone, but even Cassie's companions wouldn't have any hunch about what had happened to us. They couldn't have known about the labor hunters any more than Cassie and I had. Her comment, "I saw the damage myself," kept resurfacing in my mind. The burning of the fields and the theft of all the settlers' livestock. We had meant to scare them off. They had to leave. Our visit hadn't been pleasant. The short horn had been a warning, a chance for them to gather up their things and move on. But that was all we took. Who took the rest? Gunner was impulsive, his temper quicker than mine, and the days of standing vigil at our father's bedside had left all of our emotions ready to snap. Gunner had always voiced his objections about the settlers more loudly than any of us. But I was sure he wouldn't go off on a rampage without my approval, even if, at that time, I hadn't officially been Patre yet. He deferred to me in these matters. But if not him, who? Were the settlers or Cassie lying? That was another reason my father gave for naming me Patre. I was usually good at spotting lies, better than my brothers, but being able to discern lies didn't necessarily reveal the truth. That took more digging, and I wanted to know what her truths were. Damn it. I wanted to know a lot more about her, and that was only asking for trouble. I needed her and the other Vendans out of my life sooner rather than later. Hopefully, we wouldn't be chained much longer. I glanced at her. Tireless, her dark lashes casting a determined shadow beneath her eyes, her warm skin glistening, my gaze lingering far too long. Maybe some trouble was impossible to avoid. "What's this?" I heard the trepidation in her voice, as if she already sensed what was hidden in the half-mile-wide river of blinding sand. We had crested a knoll, and I had misjudged when we would reach it. It was midday, and the sands would be scorching, and we were bootless. "Sand," I answered. "That is not sand," she said. Not entirely. The bones were visible, small, broken, and mostly human. Dull, pitted teeth, the occasional whole vertebrae resting on top, like a white lily on a shining alabaster pond. "It's called Bone Channel," I said. "They say the sand streams from a city that was destroyed in the flash of the first star. We can't cross it barefoot in the heat of day." Shimmers of heat rippled upward. Cassie stared at it like she could see the ghosts entombed in the sand trying to claw their way to shore. Her attention rose to the distant foothills on the other side and the ruins that topped them. Our first potential shelter. But a burning graveyard lay between us. "Our shirts," she said. "We can wrap them around our feet." She began unbuttoning her shirt. "Take yours off, too. We'll need them both." "We can wait until night." "No," she said. "I'm not sleeping out here in the middle of nothing when there are ruins in sight." She took off her shirt and ripped it in half. She had a thin chemise on beneath it, and I was both hoping she would and wouldn't remove it, too. "Devil's hell, get hold of yourself, Jace." "Your shirt," she reminded me. I wasn't eager to rip it in half, but I didn't want to wait until nightfall for the sands to cool either, and with the heat of summer, we didn't really need the shirts for warmth. We wrapped our feet with several layers of fabric, tying them securely. We stepped out, the sand still feeling like a furnace beneath us, but the fabric did the job, keeping our feet from blistering. It was harder to walk with the knotted fabric pulling at our ankles, but we synchronized our steps. I tried to make conversation, thinking of other legends to tell her, but I was distracted. It wasn't that I had never seen a bare-shouldered woman before, or one so scantily clad, but somehow this felt different. She's a soldier, I reminded myself. Ratan, one who held a knife to my throat and was prepared to use it. It didn't help. Halfway across, I said, "Tell me a riddle." She looked at me surprised. "Now?" I nodded. She thought for a moment, her hand gliding over her abdomen, then said, "The less I have, the more I grow. I swirl and twirl and make a show. You can't ignore me, though hard you try. I growl and scream and wail and cry. I roost in darkness, but my bite is seen in rib and cheek and wrist so lean. With fierce teeth and sharper claw, none can escape my ruthless maw. But a strutting hen can strike me down with its pretty legs in feathered gown." My stomach told me the answer to this one. Talk of chicken legs made the beast curled in my gut lift its sorry head. "Tonight," I said, "I promise the beast will be fed." She didn't seem to hear my reply. Her right brow lifted, her gaze turned, puzzled. She looked past me over my shoulder. "What is that?" I turned. In the distance, stark against a clear blue sky, a single cloud exploded upward. It wasn't just any cloud. I had seen this kind before, but only when I was on safe high ground. It was a fat, bulging arm radiating miles into the sky. Its muscles flayed open, purple and full, like a rampaging monster. "Run," I said.
"But..."
"We're in a wash. Run!" She trusted the urgency in my voice and ran, but we were still a long way from the other side. Silver fingers of water began shining in the distance, crawling toward us. "Faster!" I yelled. Our steps pounded the sand and the fabric on her feet began unraveling, flapping loose at her ankles, but there wasn't time to fix it. In seconds, we saw the frothing wall of water coming toward us, a deadly churning wave. She kicked the fabric loose. "Keep going," she yelled, but I saw the agony in her face as she ran across the scorching sand. I scooped her into my arms and doubled my pace, my heart thudding in my chest, the wall getting closer, its roar like an animal bearing down, the trickling silver fingers already clawing at my ankles. We made it to the other side, but the water was rising, already to my knees, and we still had to make it up the steep bank. I set her down, water now up to our waists, sucking to pull us into the current. The soft soil slipped beneath our feet, rain now pouring over our heads, too. But we climbed, clawed, the water rising with us, both of us stabbing our walking sticks into the ground, stumbling, falling below the water, grabbing each other's hands, and we finally made it to the crest, stumbling and pulling ourselves over the top of the embankment just before the wall roared past us. We collapsed, lying on our backs, gasping for air, rain pounding the ground around us. And then she chuckled. The chuckle turned to a string of long, breathless laughs, and I laughed along with her. It was relieved, feverish laughter, like we had just slayed a monster that already had us in its jaws. And then our laughter subsided, both of us spent from our dash across the channel, and the only sound was the slap of the rain. The heat of the wet soil steamed up around us, and I turned my head to look at her. Her eyes were closed, strings of hair clinging to her cheek, drops of water collecting in the hollow at her throat, a small vein pulsing in her neck. I sat up and reached for one of her feet to look at the sole. She flinched at first, but then let me touch it. I gently brushed my thumb over the skin. There were already blisters forming. I reached in my pocket and pulled out a wish stalk. I chewed it, then pressed it to her foot. "Does that help?" I asked. She blinked, her eyes avoiding mine, her chest rising in an uneven breath. Then finally she answered, "Yes."
Chapter 15. Kazi.
The fire blazed and the smell of fat dripping from the Mai Mole into the flames was intoxicating, a sweet perfume finer than any found in the Jahendra. I breathed it in, heady with its scent, and my stomach churned in anticipation. The hot throb of the blisters was gone. More wish stalks were wrapped on my feet. Jace had used his own shredded shirt to make a bandage, then carried me up to the ruins. I told him I could walk, but he had insisted I needed to give the wish stalks a chance to do their magic. We found a snug, dark cubby among the tumbled and leaning walls of the ruins, and between the roasting Mai Mole and the dark cave with a roof I could almost touch, I was sure the gods had finally taken mercy on that poor, miserable wretch, Kazi, or they had just tired of tormenting her. The storm had passed quickly, gone as fast as it had come. As soon as we reached the foot of the ruins, Jace had spotted several mounds and managed to spear a Mai Mole on his second try. Once the Mai Mole had sizzled to perfection, we sat and ate, savoring the juicy dark meat, sucking on each bone, licking our fingers noisily with delight, and talking about some of our other favorite foods. He mentioned many that I had never heard of before, braised rabbit with fool's sauce, huckleberry meringue puffs, and burgoo stew. I was surprised to learn that they had four cooks at Tor's watch, but his aunt did most of the cooking. I told him about Berdy's fish stew that was a staple at Sanctum Hall. "I could eat it for every meal," I said, "and then there are sage cakes." I sighed longingly. "Never heard of those." "Then you've missed out. They're a heavenly vagabond specialty that can bring me to my knees."
"And oranges?"
His mouth pulled in a smirk, the fire casting a warm glow on his cheek.
"You like oranges?"
I smiled and conceded. "Yes, probably my favorite of all. I never had one as a child. It wasn't until I caught myself before I revealed too much. His brows rose.
"Until you what?"
"Until I traveled to Dalbrek that I tasted one. Oranges aren't available in Venda." His eyes drilled into me, knowing I was lying, and I hated that about him, that he was able to read beyond my face and words. He was quiet, and I suspected he mulled over what I said, or didn't say. He finally asked how my feet were doing. "Not stinging anymore. I think they'll be fine by morning." It was another one of those awkward moments. Our eyes meeting, lingering, looking away. After all we had been through, it seemed there should be no awkwardness left between us. But this was different. Every pause was full, like an overfilled sack of grain, the seams strained, ready to spill, filled with something we dared not explore. "Tell me another story," I said. He nodded.
"First, let me get some more wood for the fire."
He eyed the chain between us. Where one of us went, so did the other.
"You up to it?"
"I told you, the pain is gone, and I have these fine shoes you made me." He stood and reached out, helping me to my feet. My soles were tender, but the discomfort wasn't unbearable, especially with the cushion of the bandages. We walked to the cave mouth and out onto the long, wide ledge that rimmed it. Coming up the hill to the ruin, I had only seen the bank and brush in front of me. Now, looking out in the other direction from the ledge, I saw a dizzying sky of stars meeting an infinite empty plain lit only by a three-quarter moon.
"Look, up there,"
Jace said, pointing into the sky.
That's Eris's heart. And right next to it is...
I turned, my head swimming, and I reached for the ruin wall. Jace grabbed and steadied me. I just got up too fast, I said. He gazed down at me, I knew, not buying it. He had known about my strange uneasiness ever since that first night when he had asked me for a riddle in the forest.
What did they do to you, Cassie?
His voice was low, earnest. Even in the dim light, I was able to see the worry in his eyes. I pretended I didn't know what he was talking about. Who did what?
Who made you afraid of an open world? An open sky? Was it Venda? Your parents?
No one did anything, I answered quietly.
Then hold on to me, he said. Let me show you the stars.
We stood on the ledge, and he told me stories. He began with the lowest star on the horizon, Thieves Gold, he called it, because it had a distinct goldish cast. I held on to his arm, only concentrating on the single star and not everything that surrounded it, concentrating on Jace's voice and the story he wove around the glimmering gold nugget and the thieves who had tucked it into the sky, forgetting where they had buried their treasure. He moved on to another cluster of stars, Eagle's Nest, with its three bright eggs, and then another cluster, and another, until soon the whole sky was not a sky at all, but a dark parchment of glittering stories, each one connected to the next. And as he spoke, some stars streaked across the sky, alive, leaving burning tails behind them, and for those he had stories too.
They're the lost horses of Hatisha, abandoned when she fell from her chariot to the earth. They race across the heavens now, always circling, always searching for her. It's said that if she's ever found, their stars will join with her chariot once again and be the brightest in the night sky.
I stared where a streaking star had just disappeared, and an ache grew inside me. Maybe the throbbing was for a glittering sky I had never truly seen before, or maybe it was the story he told me about the lost horses. Maybe it was the thought of them circling the heavens for millennia that ached beneath my ribs. They will never find her, I thought. She is gone.
And I think, he turned toward me, that's about it.
Our faces were unexpectedly close, the moonlight cutting across his cheekbone, and suddenly I wasn't thinking about stars or runaway horses. I had forgotten that I was still gripping his arm, and I loosened my hold, returning my hand to my side.
I guess I should gather a few branches for the fire, he said.
I'll help you. I stepped forward, both of us taking quick, clumsy steps, and we bumped into each other, then tripped, the ruin wall keeping both of us from stumbling to the ground. Now his face was even closer, my back pressed to the wall, his arm braced against it. There were no more diversions. No more chances to look away. It was as though we had both given in to a moment that had been circling, waiting, trying to pounce on us all along, and now it had. He swallowed, his face only inches from mine. Long, silent seconds passed, and it felt like all the world and stars and sky were closing in on us, pressing us nearer to each other.
Do you suppose, he finally whispered, that this could be part of making the best of it?
My breath fluttered faintly in my chest. There were 100 things I should have said, but instead I answered, I think it could be. His head tilted to the side, his face lowering, and his lips barely brushed mine. Tender, slowly, leaving time for me to turn away. But I didn't. I didn't want to. His hand slid behind my back, drawing my hips to his. Rivers of heat throbbed inside me, and then his mouth pressed to mine, his tongue parting my lips, warm, sweet, gentle. His breath grew heavy and his arms closed around, drawing me closer, the heat of his touch like a fiery brand against the small of my back. My hands glided over his shoulder blades, his skin searing my fingers, his muscles tense, hard. My head spun, but in a way that I wanted to sink into, to drown in the warmth of it. I was falling into a vast, dark sky, and I didn't care. I wanted to disappear into it. I wanted more. Our tongues explored, soft, warm, and then he pulled away, his eyes searching mine, wondering, asking, should he stop? No, I thought. No, don't stop. His gaze held, waiting as if he needed to hear me say it aloud. My breath shuddered, still hot in my chest. I knew I had made a big mistake, but it was a glorious one, and I wanted to make it over and over again. But there was something in his eyes, something genuine and earnest and true that made me pause. This was more than just making the best of it. This was something taking root, a seed being planted. But it was a seed that couldn't be planted. You are Ratan, Cassie. You have a promise to keep, and you will betray him eventually. Don't do this. A fist tightened in my gut. It wasn't right. This was a line I couldn't cross. My hands slid around to his chest to push him away. But then I hesitated, my palms burning against his skin, and slowly they slid upward, rising, my fingers raking through his hair, lacing behind his head, and I pulled his mouth back to mine.
Chapter 16. Cassie.
I had always heard the ghosts. Death was no stranger in Venda. He had walked the streets boldly, rubbing his bony elbows against passers-by, whose cheeks were as gaunt as his own, his wide grin spotting you from afar, whispering,
You are next.
And I would whisper back, not yet, not today. Everyone in Venda was always just a season away from death, including me, depending on which way death turned, and his frozen grin had long ceased to frighten me. So when I saw the ghosts in Bone Channel, their bony fingers reaching out, pawing my feet, their rattled voices warning, turn back. Do not pass this way. I ignored them. Do not pass this way. But we did. And now we couldn't turn back. We had fallen through a hole and come out on the other side in a different world, a temporary world that was upside down, where everything sounded, felt, and tasted different. And every fleeting flavor of it was dangerously sweet. Jace leaned close, lifting my chin, his lips meeting mine. The best of it. That's what we told ourselves over and over again as one day rolled into the next. We were only making the best of it. It was a story, a riddle, a wish doc that we wove into every kiss, a sweet, powdered sugar that would melt and disappear on the end of our tongues. But for now, it was real enough. What was the harm? We were surviving. But as the miles we walked added up, our steps whispered a different message. each one bringing us closer to the world we had left. Heaviness would crouch in my gut, a hidden animal that wasn't fooled, no matter the stories we told ourselves. He might be one kind of person out here, but back there, he was the enemy. The lawless head of a lawless family, a family that possibly harbored a murderous war criminal who was a threat to the entire continent, and if they did, he and his family would pay. Here, I might be a girl who had helped him escape from hunters, helped heal his wounds, the girl who loved listening to his stories. But there, in the real world, I was entrusted with a job by the Queen of Venda. I was as loyal to her as he was to his family, and I would betray him when the time came. I would bring his family and dynasty to their knees. His world was about to end. The best of it. We were only making the best of it. For now. It was our story. It didn't have to have a happy beginning or a happy ending, but the middle was a feast at a banquet, a rich, soapy bath, a night's rest at an inn, and a full stomach, a warm chest nestled up against my back, the soft heat of lips at my nape, stories whispered in my ear. We stopped mid-morning to drink at a spring, then rested in the shade of an alder. Foliage was growing thicker now, the plains behind us, the foothills steeper, the mountains topped with forests looming just behind them. I lay on my back, and he hovered next to me, propped on one elbow. His finger traced a line along my jaw. He didn't ask anymore what had been done to me. Now it seemed he only wanted to erase it, wash it from my memory, and for now, I let him. "Cassie," he whispered against my cheek, and then his lips slid down my neck, and I forgot once again about the world we were heading into and thought only about this one. Another night closed in, a midnight blanket of clouds covering the stars, making our words safer. The darkness mercifully swallowed what might be seen in our eyes.
"What is this, Cassie?"
I knew what he meant. This. What was this between us? Just what game were we playing? I had wondered, too. Because now our kisses were filled with pauses, our gazes filled with more questions instead of fewer. "I don't know, Jace."
"What do you feel?"
"Your lips, your hands, your heartbeat."
"No, Cassie. In here. What do you feel in here?"
His finger stroked a line down the center of my chest. I felt an ache pressing within, a need I couldn't name. "I don't know."
I didn't want to know.
"Let me taste your mouth,"
I whispered.
"Don't make me think."
I screamed with joy when we came upon a deep pool to bathe in. We rushed toward it, stumbling, squealing, jumping into the cool, crystal water. When I surfaced, he splashed me and an all-out war began, the pool erupting with a maelstrom of blinding water and laughter until he finally grabbed my wrists so I couldn't move. Calm returned, but not to his eyes. They churned with a different kind of storm. I looked at his face, water dripping from his hair and chin, his lashes clumped together with wetness.
"I like you, Jace Ballinger," I said softly. "I think if you weren't a thief, we might be friends."
"And if you didn't whisk out knives and threaten to cut pretty necks, I think we might be friends too."
I wrinkled my nose.
"Oh, how obsessed you are with your pretty neck." His hands tightened on my wrists. He pulled me close, his teeth nipping at my neck, and between kisses he whispered, "It is not my neck I am obsessed with, Cassie of Brightmist." A cooling breeze lifted my hair, the scent of pine wafting through it, high grass swaying around our knees. We had left early, the screech of a raka startling us both awake. It flew low, its shadow nearly touching both sides of the valley. Jace confirmed that their primary diet was antelope, occasionally snatching foals or sheep, but he assured me he had never heard of them taking humans.
"At least not more than once or twice. It's never worried me, though. I hear they favor black-haired beauties, with their sour, tough meat and all."
I jabbed him with my elbow. "Where I go, you go, so you better hope it finds a nice, juicy antelope today." By mid-morning, the breeze was gone, the sun relentless, and the still air seemed to hold a foreboding hum. Maybe it was just our footsteps swishing through the grass or the endless rattle of the chain dragging between us. Maybe it sounded like a timepiece ticking off our steps. "Let's take a break," I said, and we headed for a stand of birch and lay beneath the shade on a thick bed of summer grass. But even without the rattle of the chain and the swish of our footsteps, I still heard a persistent hum and tick in the stillness of the air. It vibrated through my bones like a quiet warning. "Tell me a story, Jace," I said. "Something else about your family history." Anything to block the hum and the tick. He told me the story of Miandre. She was the first mother of all Ballingers. She came to Tor's Watch with Grayson as part of the surviving remnant when she was 13. She was only a child herself, but was forced to lead along with Grayson because the others were even younger. Like Grayson, she had watched her last living relative murdered by scavengers, so they had a common goal to create a haven where no scavenger could hurt them again. Stone by stone, the fortress they founded grew over the centuries, but they were the beginning of Tor's Watch.
"We were the first country, or as you Vendans would call it, the first kingdom."
I heard the pride in his voice. Even his eyes danced with light as he spoke. The lines of Moragiz, Venden, and Dalbrech history had blurred and overlapped each other long ago, but it was well recognized by all the kingdoms that Morrigan was the first to be established, not a rocky, out-of-the-way fortress no one had heard of until recently. And from Morrigan, the other kingdoms were born. Even Venda had been only a wild territory with no official name until the first borders were drawn. Tor's Watch was small and isolated. It was little surprise that Jace knew nothing of the history of the entire continent. I only learned most of it myself after I went to live at the Sanctum. "And all of this is written in the books you told me about?"
"Yes," he said confidently. "Every word. It was Commander Ballinger's last order to his grandson, to write it all down, and Grayson did, along with the surviving remnant, but it was mostly he and Miandre who recorded what had happened. It wasn't until almost a decade later that the two of them married and the Ballinger line began. They had 8 children together."
Babies. The Ballinger women seemed to be quite fertile. I had been careful not to cross that unwanted line that might bind Jace and me together forever. Out here, there was no protection for that. I wasn't going to risk creating a child, not when this world we were living in would disappear in only a day or two, when we fell back into the other one, and soon I would return to Venda. Jace didn't push me, as if he didn't want to cross that line either. We might be deluding ourselves for now, but he was as driven as I was, and his connection to home was strong. It showed in his face and his determined pace. Even our rests he kept short, only breaking when we came to a spring, stream, or shade. Did it hurt? I asked.